and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's announcement today of an infrastructure deal with 10 Republican senators and a number of Democratic senators, which is half of what he originally wanted, coming in at $1.2 trillion over 8 years, with $579 billion in new spending that taps into unspent money from prior relief packages and from selling off some of the strategic oil reserves. Already there has been criticism from senators like Richard Blumenthal, who described the deal as pathetic, and there is an expectation that much of what was left out will be in a budget reconciliation package that may or may not get all the Democratic senators needed on board. Joining us to discuss how much the bipartisan plan addresses the needs of the future is Jonah Hamilton, the Director of Policy in the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we will discuss the paltry $7.5 billion to create 500,000 electric chargers along highways and the $7.5 billion to make thousands of school and transit buses electric. With alarming reports from the UN that the tipping point of no return to stop the worst effects of climate change is coming sooner than previously thought, necessary investments in the future would appear to be challenges our current political and business systems are incapable of meeting. Then we'll assess what might emerge tomorrow from the bipartisan Senate negotiations led by Senators Scott and Booker on the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which passed the House in March and requires 10 Republican votes in the Senate. Joining us to discuss the extent to which the so-called bad apples, like the murderer of George Floyd, have been purged from American policing is Cheryl Dorsey, a retired Los Angeles Police Department sergeant who spent 20 years working in field-related assignments and is the author of Black and Blue, the true story of an African-American woman on the LAPD and the powerful secrets she uncovered. Then finally, we get an analysis of President Biden's strategy to deal with the rise in violent crime and proliferation of guns announced yesterday, and speak with John Pfaff, a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches criminal law, sentencing law, and law and economics. He joins us to discuss his article at The New Republic, Can Criminal Justice Reform Survive a Wave of Violent Crime? And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Jonah Hamilton, who is the Director of Policy in the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. In that role, she leads interactions with the Congress, executive branch agencies, and the White House on topics pertaining to fuel-efficient cars, electrical vehicles, and fuel policy. She also leads NGO coalitions in their joint campaign to secure strong fuel economy and greenhouse gas emission standards for passenger cars and heavy-duty trucks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonah Hamilton.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of what we know about this bipartisan agreement that President Biden announced today with 10 Republican senators and Democratic senators who have agreed on a $1.2 trillion infrastructure investment over 8 years with $579 billion in new spending? But it does seem to be pretty light on the area that you work in, particularly electric vehicles. The investment in electric vehicles is $7.5 billion to build a network of electric vehicle chargers. The goal is to build 500,000 chargers and another $7.5 billion towards making thousands of school and transit buses electric. But that's not what the original plan was, is it?
No, not at all. I would say that the current bipartisan bill framework does not actually meet the original goals of the American Jobs Plan that the president put out. This plan will not do enough to advance clean transportation, invest in advanced manufacturing, or environmental justice. So we definitely are looking forward to seeing additional action on making sure that we actually deploy electric vehicles at scale in this country.
So do you think that Nancy Pelosi has not signed off on this right away and wants more? Do you have her ear? Are you going to try and work with her? I mean, how are you going to get to where we should be, given that this is way short of the goal for the future? Because that's the part of this that I find extraordinary, is that this is not really an investment in the future.
No, that's a great question. And so far, you're right that both Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Schumer have remained committed to ensuring that climate is really addressed in any final package that moves through Congress. We certainly are talking to members of Congress and trying to make sure that everyone understands that this bipartisan package is not sufficient to move the needle on climate and not sufficient to boldly transform the transportation sector in the way that we really need to.
So what about this alternative then, this concurrent plan, that what you don't get in the deal that was announced today by Biden, you do through reconciliation? And it could be as much as over $6 trillion, according to Bernie Sanders. So is that viable? Is that going to happen? Are you going to get Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin to agree, after they've agreed to this package, then to agree to a second package, which would require their votes, because you have to have 51 votes for the reconciliation?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We certainly hope that we could, if they decide to move forward with the bipartisan package, that we could also see a further bill that includes all the tax credits that Senator Wyden just reported out of the Finance Committee on clean energy and clean transportation, as well as many other pieces of the package. I think it's going to be up to Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi to decide how they want to move all of this forward. But we certainly are advocating that they make sure that they move the broader package forward.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonna Hamilton, who is the Director of Policy with the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And given that the bottom line for the Republicans was not to raise taxes, and that they're finding money in all kinds of little pots, for example, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that, of course, means burning more gasoline, right?
That seems likely. Selling out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is something that happens sort of regularly as a pay for in Congress. That oil will be burned eventually either way. But I think, you know, the key is whether or not they are going to find sufficient pay fors to keep everyone happy to move this package forward. And I couldn't say one way or the other, honestly, if they have achieved their goal or not on that front.
And what about the other aspects of it? Money for transit, for airports, improving water and power systems, broadband investment. All of these are important, but they're well below the original $2.25 trillion that Biden asked for originally. So he talked about it as a compromise, that this is what used to happen in the Senate when he was there, and made it seem like a virtue that at least the two parties are cooperating. But it's certainly half of what he originally planned and originally wanted. So is a compromise accepting 50%?
I imagine my colleagues who work in those other areas like broadband are having very similar conversations as the climate community is on this front. I don't think that it is time to be compromising on this. You know, we elected President Biden to the White House, and he said he was going to create bold, transformative change on climate. His Build Back Better agenda, as outlined in the American Jobs Plan, is the type of transformative change that we really need to see in this country. So we are committed to trying to move this bold package and trying to ensure that we actually see the real investments in our infrastructure that we need to see for future generations.
Well, future generations, I think about my grandchildren. I mean, the UN is now telling us that the climate crisis is so much worse than was originally thought. You know, there's this sense that we're going to reach the point of no return in a few years. Well, a few years is becoming closer and closer. So how do you reconcile the alarm in the latest UN reports on how close we are to the point of no return, when the planet will start, you know, the ocean rises will start eating up countries? You know, we're now, at least in Florida, they're really realizing that they're going to lose the Keys. I don't know whether that governor there has a clue, but this is what I find extraordinary. Is the science is telling us, and you're with the Union of Concerned Scientists, so I'm sure you're on the, your hair's on fire too. I mean, isn't that what the whole idea of addressing the challenges of the future were, that this front and center of the challenge of the future is global warming and the very limited time we have to stop the point of no return?
Yeah. We completely agree. I work with a lot of climate scientists every day who are sounding the alarm internally and externally that we are reaching the point of no return. And that is exactly why we needed something like the American Jobs Plan and why we need to move that forward, so that we are making the investments now that will allow us to truly decarbonize the future across, you know, all of the sectors of the economy. This is not a time to be doing normal order. We have to really make some big changes in order to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change.
So is that to say that our political system is simply incapable of dealing with what needs to be done?
I wouldn't go that far. I think, you know, I think passing the American Jobs Plan would be a huge down payment. I don't think that we are done once we do that. The investments are not enough. We also need to put in place strong standards to reduce pollution from our cars and trucks, as well as from power plants. And I think it's possible to do all of those things. It just takes the political will to make sure we get it done.
Well, one of the earlier drafts of this plan, apparently, the Senator Sinema was saying that we could pay for it by taxing electric vehicles, which seems like completely the wrong direction to go.
Yeah, there have been a lot of efforts of late, particularly in state legislatures, to put fees on electric vehicles. Most of those have been trying to pay for roads. Ultimately, the dollar amount that you would get from doing that is very, very low. And I don't think that we want to be further taxing, I guess we already pay taxes on electric vehicles if you buy them, of the technology of the future that's going to help decarbonize the economy.
So is that the priority then, to incentivize ways to decarbonize the future?
I mean, I think that's one of the main ways to move forward new markets, right? So one of the things that we have advocated for is extending the electric vehicle tax credit, which is part of Senator Wyden's plan on the tax credits, to ensure that consumers can buy electric vehicles as they suit their lifestyle. And it helps offset the currently higher cost of the battery technology. But we expect that to drop pretty soon to when the vehicles will be cost competitive with the internal combustion engine counterparts, the gasoline engine counterparts. So I think incentivizing new technologies is definitely an important piece of it. But like I said, we also need to be making sure that we have standards in place that ensure that the companies who are producing these technologies are making them cleaner and more efficient over time.
Well, Jonna Hamilton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonna Hamilton, who is the Director of Policy at the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. In that role, she leads interactions with Congress, executive branch agencies, and the White House on topics pertaining to fuel-efficient cars, electric vehicles, and fuel policy. And she also leads NGO negotiations in their joint campaigns to secure strong fuel economy and greenhouse gas emission standards for passenger cars and heavy-duty trucks. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing what might emerge tomorrow from the bipartisan Senate negotiations led by Senator Scott and Booker on the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act.
Trains and boats and planes took you away.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Cheryl Dorsey, a retired sergeant of the Los Angeles Police Department, who worked patrol, narcotics, and vice assignments for all four bureaus of operation. Raised in South Central Los Angeles, she embarked on a career in law enforcement at an early age, beginning with the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Investigations, and Narcotics Enforcement, and spent her entire 20 years working field-related assignments, which included the infamous gang unit known as the Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH. An acclaimed author and social justice advocate, she is the author of Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto, The True Story of an African-American Woman on the LAPD, and The Powerful Secrets She Uncovered. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cheryl Dorsey.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we're expecting today or tomorrow, finally, some movement on the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And it's been a bipartisan effort underway for some time. It's been somewhat stalled, headed by Senators Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, and Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, along with Representative Karen Bass of California. The bill, of course, was approved by the Democratic House back in March. But what happened to the reform efforts after the murder of George Floyd, which we all saw on television? And there was this sense in the police community that Derek Chauvin was just a bad apple. So have police forces around the country removed their bad apples? Has that been what's happened since?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I would have to say no, just on, you know, some of the reporting that we're hearing over, you know, these months since last summer, for sure. I like to think, however, that the officers who are getting the most attention, the air quote bad apples, are in the minority, be clear. But many of these officers are repeat offenders. And so it gives the appearance that there are more of them. And we know now that police officers are walking away from specialized units. The term that's being used is that they're retiring or resigning from departments, like the rapid response team over on the Portland Police Department. But actually, they're not leaving the police department. They're just stepping away from these specialized units. And so I say, if these officers are really bothered by the fact that they can't abuse and mistreat people of color, Black people primarily, then they should leave the department wholesale. Don't just leave a unit, just leave the whole profession. And so I don't see that this is just anything that's likely to change in the near future.
Well, in terms of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, apparently the holdup has been over qualified immunity. And the Republicans have argued that eliminating the protection of qualified immunity would harm police recruitment, while the Democrats apparently have been insisting that police officers should be held accountable. And Tim Scott, the Republican, has proposed that the police departments, not the individual officers, be held liable. So presumably tomorrow we'll find out more about what they've come up with in these negotiations. But how would you come down on that, Cheryl?
Well, if we understand that what Tim Scott said is true, which is getting rid of qualified immunity would be a non-starter in any negotiation, then that leaves me to believe that qualified immunity was taken off the table as he promised. And so for me, anything that doesn't include removing qualified immunity is useless. Having a police department be held responsible, and we're talking financially, right? Because right now the taxpayers shoulder the burden of any civil lawsuit that's settled because of an errant officer. And so to move that financial burden from taxpayers would be helpful, but to put it on the department rather than the individual officer is problematic. What have you taught that officer? What has he learned? What are his peers thinking about their actions as they move forward? We know that Derek Chauvin had over 18 personnel complaints on that department. So putting him on a national registry is not going to stop anything. He was already on a list. Garrett Roth, the officer who shot and killed Rayshard Brooks in the back as he ran away, had over a dozen personnel complaints. And most recently, there was a police officer who's been charged on the Columbus Police Department after having been fired for the fatal shooting of a black man, Andre Hill, unarmed, and he had over 90 complaints, 16 of them sustained. That means he did that wrongdoing. He was engaged in misconduct. And so if you don't hold these officers accountable, this George Floyd Reform and Justice Act, in my mind, is useless. The talk of no-knock warrants is also mentioned in this reform bill. And actually, the no-knock warrants are only going to be prohibited by federal officers. Has nothing to do with local municipalities, and those are the people who are serving no-knock warrants. Those are the officers who were involved in the fatal killing, the murder of Breonna Taylor, not federal officers, local police officers. So eliminating federal no-knock warrants, again, is pointless.
And again, I'm speaking with Cheryl Dorsey, who's a retired sergeant of the Los Angeles Police Department who worked patrol, narcotics, and vice assignments for all four bureaus of operation. Raised in South Central Los Angeles, she embarked on a career in law enforcement at an early age, beginning with the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Investigations, and Narcotics Enforcement, and spent her entire 20 years working field-related assignments, which included the infamous gang unit known as the Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH. An acclaimed author and social justice advocate, she is the author of Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto, The True Story of an African-American Woman on the LAPD, and The Powerful Secrets She Uncovered. So in terms of morale, and you mentioned what has been going on with the Portland Police Department, where they've been, well, they've sort of shuffled off, they've pretended, I guess, to quit, but they haven't, especially our unit. But overall, there's been a survey done by the Police Executive Research Forum, which is a Washington Policy Institute, that almost 200 police departments around the country have found retirements are up 45% and resignations rose by 18% in the year from April 2020 to April 2021 compared with the previous 12 months. And then in New York City alone, 2,600 officers retired in 2020 compared to 1,500 the year before. In Seattle, the resignations increased to 123 from 34 and retirements from 96 to 43. In Minneapolis, which had 912 uniformed officers in May of 2019, is now down to 699. So what's going on across the country?
Well, the officers are their feelings are hurt because, as I stated, you know, they're being held accountable for engaging in police misconduct and, in some instances, murder. Officers are now finally finding themselves facing criminal charges. And so in protest, and this is not anything new, I've heard police officers during my tenure talk about work slowdowns, not responding to radio calls in a timely manner. Back in my day, you know, the term that was bantered around was the blue flu, when officers weren't happy with what was going on and morale was alleged to have been low. So I say, good riddance. Get rid of these officers who are resigning because they can't engage in misconduct and abusive behavior. There are those others who are retiring probably because they have years in grade and they can do so and receive a pension. Good for them. And let's hire officers who are more like-minded, there to protect and serve, more guardians, fewer warriors on these departments. But factually, it doesn't seem as if these police chiefs have an appetite to hire officers who aren't going to abuse their authority. We know that on the Seattle Police Department, there was a black female police chief by the name of Carmen Best who came in and tried to do her level best to change the police culture. And when they ran her out on a rail, the first thing the city council did was reverse seniority, fire everybody that she had hired, over 100 officers, primarily black officers. And so the problem is that these police chiefs are complicit, the fish rots from the head, and we have seen them condone in bad behavior, cover up in the case of Ronald Green, Louisiana state trooper head over there. His name was Lamar Davis, a black man, hid the video that showed Ronald Green being murdered for 2 years from the family. And now he's clutching his pearls and pretending like, you know, somehow that they're in the midst of an investigation and they were going to release this information, but for it having been leaked. The fish rots from the head. The problem is with the police chiefs, and the community has an affirmative responsibility to hold them accountable. Every police chief serves at the pleasure of a mayor or an elected city manager, and they understand one thing, and that's votes. Get rid of them too.
So is there a problem, though, in the way that policing has been framed in this country? For example, politicians talk about the war on crime, the war on drugs, and if you have a police department that feels that every day that they put on the uniform and head out on patrol, that they're going on patrol as if they're in Iraq or Afghanistan. And indeed, apparently there's been a lot of recruiting from vets from these recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there have been some reports that the mindset of some of these vets is that when they're patrolling the streets of, say, of Los Angeles, if they've just come back from Iraq or Afghanistan, they're looking upon the local residents in the way that they look upon the streets of Baghdad and Kabul as being enemy territory.
Well, certainly, you know, this job is not for everybody. And while police departments have, particularly the LAPD, used to look towards military because we were quasi-military when I joined for recruits, certainly that's a problem, and background checks need to be looked into further. Psychological evaluations reoccurring need to happen, but let's not pretend that recruitment isn't up from those in the ranks of the KKK. The FBI has been telling us for almost two decades that the KKK has infiltrated these 18,000 police departments across the United States. And so if you don't address that issue, if you don't figure out what to do with those who did join for the wrong reason, who are there and who are part of that small select minority that are getting all of the attention in communities of color by using excessive force, unnecessary force, and then escalating those situations to deadly force, then this is going to continue to happen. The bottom line is accountability. And I think police chiefs should look to colleges where kids have an interest in law enforcement and social justice and recruit from those ranks, and then once you get them on the job, psychologically reevaluate, because officers are exposed to things day in and day out that can twist your thinking environmentally. It can be a partner. And why wouldn't you, as a CEO of an organization, want to make sure that your employees are in a good headspace? It makes no sense to me.
Well, we saw, I don't know whether how many were KKK, but we saw an awful lot of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites attack the nation's capital on January the 6th. And the Republicans have been trying to gaslight the country ever since and rewrite history. They refused to have a bipartisan commission looking into it. And the new version of the history that has been promulgated by Trump and who controls the GOP is that they are, in fact, Black Lives Matter and Antifa people attacked the Capitol. And 7 out of 10 Republicans believe that they're people that attacked the Capitol. And by the way, they attacked the police. That's what happened on January the 6th. The victims of that attack were policemen and policewomen. And some were killed and many were badly injured. And there's been no justice for them. So there's been this amazing amount of gaslighting going on. As I say, 7 out of 10 Republicans believe that the people who attacked the Capitol on January the 6th were Antifa and Black Lives Matter posing as Trump people. So that's a huge problem, obviously. And then on top of that, all of the talk about justice and racial reform following the George Floyd murder, to some extent, the Republicans again have changed the subject, trying to come up with a new narrative saying, the real problem in this country is critical race theory, that somehow, you know, whites are being taught terrible stuff in schools, you know, that demonize white people, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, critical race theory is not taught in schools. But you see what I'm saying, Cheryl, that there's been a a very good propaganda offensive underway to change the subject here. So how do you get the subject changed back to where it should be?
Well, I think you continue to speak truth to power and honestly about what's going on. And while the Republicans can say whatever they want about the January 6th insurrection, I don't know if that's what they believe or that's just what they say, because there is a whole segment of society out there who are uninformed, uneducated, and are willing to believe whatever is being fed to them. We know truthfully now, based on their own admission, as these people just this week who were charged in the insurrection on January 6th are pleading guilty. And these are Oath Keepers and other groups that are like-minded who stormed the Capitol. And I just, my heart breaks when I see these officers from that police department who come on television and talk about the injuries they still suffer, their inability to sleep and probably even eat because of what was done to them. And to know that in the ranks of the insurrectionists were other police officers, a NYPD officer who's retired is facing charges. There were military folks who were in that group. And so, again, goes back to what I said, everybody who wants to be the police shouldn't be the police. And we're seeing the evidence of that in these people who are being charged with the January 6th insurrection. So we have to have an honest discussion about the problem. If we can't admit that there's something wrong, then we'll never get to the fix.
So just in closing, Cheryl, yesterday President Biden announced a new strategy to deal with the rise in crime, particularly the 33% rise in homicides in a year. And he also dealt with the proliferation of guns. And in terms of guns, of course, in contrast to what the president was saying yesterday, in Texas, the governor just signed a bill allowing people to conceal carry handguns without a license or without any training. So that's what's happening on the ground in Texas. And some of the president's proposals sound like they'll be very helpful, particularly in terms of basically making sure that anyone with a federal gun license who allows a sale to go through to a felon, and this goes on all the time, all of the inner city shootings in Chicago, the guns are bought in Indiana from gun dealers. So he's trying to close that loophole and make it one strike and you're out in terms of anybody. They'll lose their federal gun license if they do an illegal sale. But I heard an interview recently with the former chief of LAPD and New York, NYPD as well, Chief Bratton. And he was asked in the interview, how come there are so many police shootings in this country compared in the UK, for example, where there's basically single-digit shootings in 1 year in the UK, as opposed to in the hundreds here in the United States, or even the thousands. I'm not sure the actual statistics, but still, the contrast is huge. And Bratton said, well, the problem is that American policemen, policing, you have to be ready to use your gun because the criminals out there are all armed. So that led me to think, my God, how come the police departments in this country aren't against the NRA? So why is it that the police in this country aren't up in arms about the proliferation of guns? And now you have in Texas the fact that anybody can have a concealed weapon without training. That's insane.
It certainly is to me as well, but to allude to every criminal, every criminal is armed? Listen, I spent 20 years working patrol on the Los Angeles Police Department, and I worked every part of the city. I worked the gang detail, and it wasn't uncommon for me to have a suspect run away from me or be uncooperative, combative, non-compliant, verbally abusive with me, and I shot no one. I was able to take bad guys when I worked the gang unit, Crash, who were engaged in drive-by shootings almost on a daily basis, take them into custody without incident, the same way we see white officers take armed white men into custody after they've engaged in mass shootings without incident. So it can be done if an officer has an appetite to do that. But if you know that you're not going to be held accountable, if you know that your police department and your police unions, your fraternal order of police and benevolent police officer associations get excited about every shooting of a Black man, woman, or child that they see, why would you do anything different? With regards to what the president is trying to do in terms of gun reform, I don't say no to anything, but the horse is out of the barn. What do we do about the guns that are already out there, the ones that are being passed illegally from person to person or sold from person to person, not at gun shows or legitimate legal businesses? What do we do about that? I think maybe the president should have a fireside chat with these mayors, who, again, are all elected officials, incentivize them to hold their police chiefs and their sheriffs and their commissioners more accountable for what goes on in local cities and counties. Because if the police department, and you see in Texas what they're doing, if the police department isn't going to enforce these federal laws that are being mandated, passed down, if there's no incentive for them to do that, then again, why would the local police department do that? Police chiefs have so much autonomy and so much control over what they will and will not do on their police department. And so unless they're held to answer, then things are going to continue on the way that they have. And all of what the president said sounds good and sexy, but really, I don't know what it's going to do to stop the 60 shootings that's probably going to happen this weekend in Chicago.
Well, Cheryl Dorsey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Cheryl Dorsey, who's a retired sergeant of the Los Angeles Police Department, who worked patrol, narcotics, and vice assignments for all four bureaus of operation. Raised in South Central Los Angeles, she embarked on a career in law enforcement at an early age, beginning with the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Investigations, and Narcotic Enforcement, and spent her entire 20 years working in field-related assignments, which included the infamous gang unit known as the Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH. An acclaimed author and social justice advocate, she's the author of Black and Blue, The Creation of a Manifesto, The True Story of an African-American Woman on the LAPD, and The Powerful Secrets She Uncovered. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of President Biden's strategy to deal with the rise in violent crime and proliferation of guns announced yesterday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Pfaff, who is a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches criminal law, sentencing law, and law and economics. His research focuses primarily on the causes of the unprecedented 40-year boom in U.S. incarceration rates and the role that prosecutorial discretion has played in driving up prison populations. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And he has an article at the New Republic, Can Criminal Justice Reform Survive a Wave of Violent Crime? Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfaff.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And yesterday, President Biden announced his strategy to combat violent crime, which is there's been a 33% spike in homicides in the last year. Prior to his announcement yesterday in the White House, he met with big city mayors who are on the front lines, if you will. But let's begin with the politics of it, John, because I had a feeling that what Biden was doing yesterday was to get ahead of the anticipated Republican push during the upcoming election to paint the Democrats as being soft on crime and paint Biden as being somehow tied to this idea of defunding the police.
Yes, I'm sure that's what's motivating his action. And I think there's a couple of things to important to keep in mind in there is that while the politics of that are real, they're also very cynical in that there's very little that the president can actually do to shape crime in the United States. Criminal policy is a deeply local issue. You know, the police department, they don't respond to the president. We have somewhere between 15 to 19,000 independent police departments who respond at most to a mayor or a county executive. We have 2,200 district attorneys nationwide who respond to no one but the voters in their counties. And so this idea that somehow trends in crime rest with the president, whatever causes and drives crime, the president is not the one in charge, but he does get a lot of attention, and I understand his political concerns. That said, this idea that the only way one can respond to violence is through traditional tough on crime practices is wrong as a matter of policy. It was also the politics of it are very interesting, right? And I think where you see the politics most interestingly and strikingly was in the district attorney race in Philadelphia last month, in which Larry Krasner, who is one of the more progressive prosecutors in the country, was being challenged by someone on the very much more traditional tough on crime ticket, had supported the police union, this guy Carlos Vega. And not only did Krasner easily defeat Vega, but Krasner actually did better in the districts that had higher rates of shootings, right? Which means that the people who are themselves oftentimes most the victim of violence are the ones who are also often most supportive of reforms. And so when conservative politicians say we have to be tough on crime in this police prison driven kind of way, because that's what the people affected by crime deserve, those people are telling us at the ballot booth time and time again in local elections, that is not actually what they want.
Well, a similar thing's happening here in Los Angeles with the District Attorney George Cascone, who's a progressive reformer. He's under attack from the police unions.
Yeah, and in San Francisco too, with Chesa Boudin. There's one of the more interesting things I think we've seen happen policy-wise over the past year or two, which I think is a very positive development, is a growing awareness and appreciation that the police are by no means sort of these objective describers of the situation. They are deeply political actors who feel tremendous amount of pressure, perhaps the most amount of sort of cultural and political pushback since the civil rights movement. And I think there's a growing awareness of just not that power, but also political distrust. You know, you see media institutions. I saw the NPR tweet about this just yesterday, which they are being much more explicit about how, you know, we're not entirely sure the police are being honest with us when they tell us what's happening or try to explain what is going on. You see that in their aggressive lobbying in DA races and in other situations like that. And they are oftentimes losing. You know, the New York City had their primary for mayor a couple days ago. We still don't know who is going to win the Democratic nomination entirely. It looks like it's going to be a former police chief, but the police association didn't like him. The police unions actually had their own candidate who got like 4% of the vote, right? And so they're losing more often than they're used to, and you can sort of sense the concern amongst them because of that.
Right, but what is the takeaway from what happened in the New York mayoral race? Now, it's not over yet, but
right.
A former policeman who used to be a Republican beat out a police reformer, a police watchdog. So does that mean that the public in the most liberal city in the country, it's entirely Democratic city, is that a signal to the Democrats that the public are against ideas like defund the police?
I think it's very hard to give a single coherent story to what happened in New York last night. If nothing else, about 1 million people voted in a city of 9 million. So it's not the city as a whole. But also, you know, Adams, the former police captain and the current front runner, yes, he's a former police captain, but he also quit the police years ago, right? It's sort of in protest of what he viewed as sort of their misbehavior. The police themselves came out against him as a candidate. Like, they don't see him as their candidate. The police unions actually mocked him and sort of denigrated him. You also see other districts. For example, there's one thing I know, because I saw the results earlier today, that went strongly for Adams, but it also went strongly when voting for their city council person, for this woman, Tiffany Caban, who almost won as the DA for Queens, and who's aggressively a reformer. You know, she believes in decriminalizing sex work and decriminalizing all drug cases, and is actually one of the more progressive policies out there. So people were splitting their vote between Eric Adams, who's sort of a mainline Democrat, and Tiffany Caban, who's a very much a much more extreme reformer. You know, at the same time that Eric Adams is going to be the mayor, you know, Manhattan chose as their district attorney someone who's going to be much more progressive than the person he defeated in sort of who were the top two in that race. So there's no simple, coherent story. And the fact is, you know, Eric Adams has been running for mayor. He's sort of been building up for this for decades now, right? He's been building sort of his connections and his ties to sort of the whole city machine. There's a lot of sort of very local, just generic politics at play in Adams' win that I think defy any sort of simple story about what this means for broader criminal justice reform.
But the person coming in second, Maya Wiley, she was a police watchdog, was she not?
She was, right? Which, A, tells you there's still a fair amount of support for that, right? But also, you know, like I said, you know, people were splitting their vote between Adams and people who on the city council will actually be setting the budget for the police department. And so a district in Queens voted for Adams, and they elected someone who has made it very clear she has a very strong desire to deeply slash the NYPD's budget. So what do those people think? It's confusing and complicated. And, you know, I think a lot of political scientists are quick to say that elections, you know, ideology is oftentimes a secondary or a tertiary reason for why people vote. Adams has been out on the streets making connections, shaking hands for years now in anticipation of running for mayor. Right? There's more here than just seeing this one particular race as some sort of broader referendum.
And again, I speak with John Pfaff, who's a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches criminal law, sentencing law, and law and economics. His research focuses primarily on the causes of the unprecedented 40-year boom in U.S. incarceration rates and the role that prosecutorial discretion has played in driving up prison populations. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And he has an article at the New Republic, Can Criminal Justice Reform Survive a Wave of Violent Crime? And back to your article, what did you make of President Biden's proposals about curbing the proliferation of guns? I mean, at the same time, just before the president made his announcement yesterday, of course, the governor of Texas signed a bill allowing a concealed carry in the state of Texas. Anybody can carry concealed weapons without any training whatsoever. So you have that's happening at on the one level. On the other level, President Biden's the main takeaway seems to have been that they're going to police those with federal gun licenses who any incident of selling a gun without a background check to somebody who shouldn't have a gun would immediately mean the suspension of your license. Now, I don't know exactly in terms of the overall challenge that we have with the proliferation of guns and the 33% rise in homicides. I'm not sure what kind of impact that will have. What do you think, John?
Yeah, so putting aside exactly what is the best way to manage gun control, right, which is an incredibly challenging policy question, you know, I think Biden is on the right side on the more macro policy, which is everyone's been yelling back and forth. Is it COVID? Is it the protest? Is it defunding? Is it police discouragement? And I think one of the most likely causal explanations for this rise in homicides and shootings that doesn't get as much attention as it deserves is before the protests, around the time that the lockdown started, you saw a massive and still ongoing surge in gun purchases, right? And so the volume of guns entering into the population has been higher than sort of, as far as you can tell, ever before. We actually, in recent history, you know, we don't have great data on gun purchases. We are willfully blind as to the sell and transfer of guns because we don't want really to know that number. But the sort of the indirect measures you have, whether it's looking at requests for gun licenses or police seizures of illegal guns off the street, what we're seeing is a substantial rise in just the volume of guns in the public. And that's clearly playing a non-trivial role in the homicides that we've seen recently.
Not just illegal guns, but there's been a massive uptick in legal purchases during this COVID period. But in your article, you talk about, for example, Chicago, the homicides going on there. And the fact of the matter is, for the longest time, the guns that are used in these crimes, first of all, the ATF have always had a hard, they've been hamstrung. They have a hard time tracing these guns. But when you pick up a gun at a murder scene, it ends up being traced back to somewhere like Indiana, where they have lax gun laws. And that's the loophole that Biden is trying to close. But is anybody talking about what drives the homicide rate among these inner city gang shootings, which, as far as I can tell, most inner city gangs are basically in the drug business? And isn't that what fuels inner city gangs and the homicides that, that are attendant to that?
So I think the first thing that's important to realize, homicides rose everywhere, right? We like to point to sort of big cities as sort of this, the paradigmatic place where homicides have gone up. But they've gone up in big cities, small cities, medium-sized cities, rural areas. Homicides went up everywhere, right? And so it's not, I don't think it's a proper way to frame this to say, so what about Chicago gangs? Partly because talking about Chicago at this point has become a tricky city to talk about because it was used by the Trump administration for so many years as sort of as a metaphor for something much more than just Chicago, right? He chose Chicago because of where Obama came from. He chose Chicago because of the racial story behind Chicago. And you know, it became sort of this target of people's attention, even though it wasn't even the deadliest city in the Midwest. So why were we always focused on Chicago? There are some deeper problems with our focus on Chicago. But it's important to also realize that homicides went up across the board, big, medium, and small, right? And while, yes, the larger, more structured criminal gangs in major cities do often are engaged in drugs. We don't really have a good sense of exactly where these shootings take place. We also do know, for example, that COVID did appear to have led to an increase in domestic violence. Some of the shootings are going to be tied to that, right? But also there's substantial evidence that just it's less poverty and more a sudden change in like economic stability can have a huge impact on violent behavior. And COVID did that to an unprecedented scale, right? And so disentangling the connection between sort of guns and COVID and underlying causes is going to take a long time to disentangle. And anyone who confidently tells you exactly what it is being dishonest because, you know, to be fair, criminologists to this day struggle to explain why crime dropped from 1994 to the present, right? We've had 40 years to explain that and 30 years, and we still struggle. The idea that we have a solid understanding of what caused homicides to spike 6 months ago is just hubris. Right. And so, yes, there are some of the structural reasons, things probably of sort of the entrenched poverty and the drug markets those bring with them. Does the rise in gun ownership perhaps aggravate that? Sure. But COVID aggravated domestic violence. COVID aggravated stress overall. COVID brought economic shocks to big cities, small towns all across the board. And they all saw a rise. And so the story is much more complicated than just sort of, you know, drug gangs in major cities.
Well, surely what complicates the story is the fact that there's been so much gaslighting going on about crime, and particularly since January the 6th, the storming of the Capitol, where the police were the victims. And 7 out of 10 Republicans, thanks to Donald Trump, who controls GOP, now believe that the people who stormed the Capitol were Antifa and Black Lives Matter people in disguise pretending to be Trump supporters. So the whole narrative that's followed the murder of George Floyd, which we saw on camera, and the subsequent George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which the House passed, and now apparently tomorrow, Friday, we may hear what Tim Scott and Cory Booker have come up with in terms of the Senate bill. But the gaslighting is extraordinary that's been going on. And the whole narrative has changed about justice for African Americans in this country. The Republicans are hoisting this canard about critical race theory being taught in schools, which is not even true. And of course, that's right. A way to distract from the need for racial justice with this bogus argument that somehow whites are being demonized and that's being taught to school kids in this country, all of which is complete nonsense. So how much do you think this toxic political environment where the Republicans derailed the possibility of having a commission looking into what happened, which we all saw before our eyes on January the 6th, and now we're being told what you saw before your eyes is not what happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think historically, claims about law and order, that phrase in particular, have rarely been about actually wanting to use the law to restore order. They're about sort of triggering people's fears, especially racial fears, about disorder and using it to justify control. And, you know, in general, crime policy, like I said, is driven much more at the local level than at the federal level. There's actually not much the feds can do when it comes to crime policy. And, you know, the bills they're passing might be laudable, but they're not going to be transformative. Where I get more concerned is Republican state legislators are passing all sorts of laws to make reform harder in the cities using sort of this this fear about disorder and crime to push them through, right? So Florida and Texas have already just passed laws that make it very hard, if not impossible, not to like defund the police department, just to cut a police department's budget almost at all, right? You're seeing pushes in various states to make it harder, to make it easier for state attorney generals to take cases away from local county DAs, which are very much clearly aimed at allowing Republican attorney generals to take over prosecution in more liberal cities that elect more liberal district attorneys, right? And so whatever's going on in Congress, what's really actually the deeper and more troubling but far less obvious threat to reform efforts are states passing all these what strict what cities can do. And while there are constitutional limits on how the feds can boss around the states, there's no constitutional limit on how the states can boss around the cities. So if the state legislator tells the city, you can't do this, then the city can't do that. And there's nothing the city can do in response. And to me, and because this is like state legislative policy, it's not going to be on the front page of the New York Times in the way that, you know, the George Floyd Justice Act in Congress will be, it's kind of flying under the radar. But the impact in the long term of these efforts by states to regulate their cities is going to be much bigger.
Well, a good example of that, just in closing, John Pfaff, was that in Boulder, Colorado, the city passed an ordinance banning assault rifles. And this character came in with an assault rifle and murdered people in a supermarket. But before that happened, the state overrode the city of Boulder's ban on assault rifles. And this guy had no problem buying an assault rifle and killing, I think, about 10 or 11 people.
Yeah, I believe 40-some states already have laws in place that tell cities they cannot pass any gun control law more extreme than what the state has already passed, right? That happened decades ago in most places, that they already have these laws in place. And now you see 13, 14, 15 states trying to make it impossible to change police budgets. You see 5 or 6 states going after sort of local DAs. Like, as criminal justice reform has gone from sort of marijuana legalization, which everyone kind of agrees with, to something much more substantive, we are seeing a substantial upsurge in state legislators trying to shut down these efforts before they even start.
Well, John Pfaff, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, Abby, speak with John Pfaff. He's a professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches criminal law, sentencing law, and law and economics. His research focuses primarily on the causes of the unprecedented 40-year boom in U.S. incarceration rates and the role that prosecutorial discretion has played in driving up prison populations. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And he has an article at The New Republic, Can Criminal Justice Reform Survive a Wave of Violent Crime? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay.